In 2002, the world's attention turned briefly to the fate of women sentenced to death by stoning for adultery in northern Nigeria. 12 of Nigeria's 19 predominantly Muslim northern states have adopted Sharia law since 1999. Safiya Hussaini had been sentenced to death, but was acquitted in appeal in March 2002, this on the grounds that the baby had been conceived before Sharia law was enacted. Fearing ethno-religious tensions, the Nigerian government did not intervene. 3 days after Safiya's acquittal, Amina Lawal lost her case. 30-year-old Amina, who had been married, bore a daughter 16 months after her divorce. Her partner at the time originally admitted to being the father of the child, but later withdrew the statement. Amina lost her first appeal in August 2002 and is sentenced to be buried up to her waist and stoned to death. The Miss World competition was moved from the capital of Nigeria, Abuja, to London amidst Muslim protests about a parade of nudity and beauty queens threatening to boycott the event because of Amina's sentence. Since then, little more has been heard. Amina, however, still remains sentenced to death in 2004 after she has weaned her daughter. On the 5th of March, her attorney, Hawa Ibrahim, gave a talk in Amsterdam on women's rights under Sharia law. She made a number of important and interesting points, including the difference between Muslim and Sharia law, one which is the law of the people, the other which is the law of God. She also stated that Sharia law, if properly applied, gives a number of very important rights, including the right to life. Sarah O'Gorman interviews her.
Can you tell me, where is Amina now and how is she doing?
Amina is in our village. She's doing okay. Her health has not been very good. Even from the beginning, she had ulcer, but she's generally okay.
How surprised were you and Amina by the outpouring of interest and concern and the outcry from all over the world at this case?
We only got to know a little bit of it when the Miss World came to Nigeria. Amina has no access to radio or to television, and she doesn't know how to read or write.
But you as a lawyer, do you?
Yes, of course I do. But I have so many cases that one of my pastime is not newspaper specific, but I do. But during the Miss World contest in Nigeria, and a lot of international journalists poured into the country, I hope to cover that event, though somehow linked to Amina Lawal. We got to know that there is attention. We are hearing from them that there's a lot of demonstration in their different countries. I think we had over 100 international journalists that we attended to. We also, I was invited by the Senate members of the Senate of the United States, then led by Senator Tom Daschle, the majority leader. I came to Nigeria last year. The Italian Parliament, the Human Rights, that is the Senate, I was invited to see them. I've also had to brief European Union ambassadors in Nigeria. So from that perspective, yes, we know that there are a lot of people that are outpouring their support for the rule of law and due process. And it gives me as a person a lot of joy. I'm not sure Amina understands so much of that. But what she only understands, and what she kept on saying, is that she believed God is on her side and God will not allow her to suffer punishment that she doesn't know.
Could you tell us a little bit about the background of her case and how you came to represent her?
I mean, she was taken before the court in January, in December. At that time, her baby was 8 days old. She was convicted on the 25th of January. On the 25th of March 2002. We came into the matter on the 28th of March and we filed our appeal 2002. What happened was that Baobab Women's Human Rights based in Lagos had contacted me in 1999 to put up a legal team for the first case. So in October 1999, I put up a legal team for Baria Ibrahim Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some few experience, and we had other cases, indeed 13 other cases. One of them was Safia Hosseini. And we're coming back after the judgment that said discharge and acquitted Safia Hosseini. We were told by the BBC reporter Dan Isaac that there was this case in Bakori. Do we know about it? We said no.
So you learned about it from a BBC reporter?
Yes, we did. Yes, I did personally.
You did?
Personally, yes. I have always been independent counsel. I have my law firm with a strength of 8 lawyers, small one. And I'm doing it not because anybody is paying me nothing. I believe from my own background where I am coming from, how I grew up, I thought the only best thing I can give back to my community is the education that I have, is my skill as a lawyer. So I came into the matter in all these cases, mm-hmm. Not being paid, and up to now, nothing by nobody, is just conviction. My conviction in the fact that we must uphold the rule of law and ensure that this poor woman from my same background are not victims of a law that they don't understand. And because of the nature of cases I'm doing, I'm not making so much money in my other cases. So I'm living barely from my hand to my mouth. And for me, money is never part of it.
Not part of it.
At all.
Then I can feel that.
Secondary aspect of what I'm doing. Since we are lawyers, we are not politicians, we are not social scientists, we are not even Islamic jurists, we are just simple lawyers. What we have decided to do is to stick to the law. And for now, we are only sticking to the codified Sharia penal court law of those states. We are saying, please, this is the rule of law, this is what the law is saying, just apply it. But we appeared before the court about 9 times. And then we argued our case. The state sent their representations. They came and argued the case of the state, seeking that the conviction of the child court should be affirmed. Now, the conviction of the child court, they got her, she was charged for adultery,
mm-hmm.
because she was married,
mm-hmm.
And divorced. And the punishment was she should be stoned to death. And the date that the trial court gave is the 20th day of September 2003.
Mm-hmm. Maybe could you like to just give us a picture, take us back, so Amina can be being a typical, a poor woman, uneducated woman living in a village.
Uneducated, poor,
mm-hmm.
Never knew about the existence of this aspect of strict Sharia interpretation.
Would she have known that Sharia was have been declared in her state?
No, she didn't know. It was something that came through, we understand, the legislators. But as far as Amina is concerned,
mm-hmm.
it's a small village with no electricity. She has no access to radio. Of course, she cannot read and write. So even if it existed, she never knew, because she's not privileged, she's not educated, she has no means of knowing. She has no radio to listen to. So she never knew about the existence of a strict interpretation or new legal system in the state, so she never knew. Now, at the trial, Amina had no lawyer. But she didn't even know.
She had no lawyer. How did that happen? Why not?
Almost all the 13 cases I mentioned to you, none of them have any understanding at all of what is happening. They don't know what is their right. They don't know whether... they didn't even know what was happening. So apparently she was brought to court. But I think one of the things I also noticed was that she was brought to this court from her own small village. And, the environment of the court is different.
Mm-hmm.
She was coming from a mud house, a thatched roof, coming to this four-wall building, made with cement, painted,
mm-hmm.
With a stage. With a judge there, she could have been intimidated even by the environment. So you have a situation where it's a woman that understands nothing and brought.
Do you feel it's a deliberate effort on the part of the state and those state authorities to intimidate poor, uneducated women? And if so, why?
I do not think really that is the intention. But I think that not so much had been said about it, especially at the grassroots for people to realize that there is something that is going on, that always on.
Safia Husseini, who had been sentenced to stoning previously, she said about her case that only I will be punished because the injustice of the law is that men are not punished for impregnating women. I insist that my crime is not adultery but pregnancy. Since only women can be pregnant, this means that the real crime is being a woman. The man will always commit adultery and escape. The woman is the only one who can ever conceive the unknowing depository of the traitor's semen. Do you agree with her that the real crime is to be a woman?
I'm not sure that is Safia's quotation because it's so smooth.
For an uneducated woman, I'm impressed.
It's so smooth. I'm not sure it's a quotation that she could have given. But yes, this is one of our fundamental fears. From my own experience of 27 cases, 13 of which are adultery, mainly most of them are to be convicted to be stoned to death. But out of the 13, only one is a man. And he wasn't charged for adultery, really. It was a court that framed the charge to now look adultery. He was never charged for adultery. So our fears as women is that we will have a situation, if that is not checked, that, you know, it's only the woman that has been brought before the court and convicted. You know, it's like a license to the men to go and just keep on impregnating the women, because of course you will get free, nobody will get hold of you. So I think the system must consider some of this very grievous danger within the same system. Because if you do, there is no way of you tracking down the man, charging him and convicting him within the due process of law, then you expose the woman to more dangers, because you know it's just like let's just go and do it. After all, I will not be caught. And so I think that is an area that we have raised a lot of concern in the country and with our Islamic jurist, and it's also part of the law is not helpful, because the section 124 that deals with that defined the offense of zina, which is adultery, gave some proofs, and one of the proofs, three basic proofs: one, that the woman, that person charged and convicted must confess. Confession. The second is the presence of four witnesses seeing the act being done. Men witness the crime in the act, not only witness it, they are covered. No, you must witness the act without, in fact, one of the interpretations say you cannot pass a small trait in between the two parties. Four witnesses, men of sound mind and all the categories.
And in any of these ladies' cases, has that been the fact? Has it been
never. Maybe I need to mention the third ground, which is the pregnancy.
Oh, okay.
Now, these are the three basic grounds, but you know, when you only speak about pregnancy, it's a problem, because it's only the woman that get pregnant. Now, about the issue of four witnesses, we have argued in the past that is and pregnancy and witnesses and confession. But the court said no,
or
one of them could be just So this confession or four witnesses or pregnancy. When you say only pregnancy, only the man, a woman that gets pregnant. So that has been part of what we have been contending.
Okay, and did you also argue in the case that a pregnancy itself shouldn't be conclusive evidence of adultery?
Yes. This is one of our basic arguments, that pregnancy alone cannot be and shouldn't be, knowing fully well that the science had advanced so much so that the definition of that zina, which is essentially saying that when you are charged for zina, it means that you have sexual intercourse, that is the definition, sexual intercourse with a man that does not, or a man or woman that does not have that sexual right over you, and you must have done it through the genital. Now that is the definition under the law, through the genital. And now with the advance of science, that could also be punctured. So we hope that they will look into some of this provision with a more broad mind of trying to ensure that it falls within what is reality, what is practical, and what is within the rule of law and due process.
Okay, can you tell me a bit where, because does the Sharia legislate for this discrimination in the case of, if the Sharia says that, Sharia law says that adultery is a crime, does it stipulate that a woman should be punished more than a man, and that the woman is more guilty than a man?
No.
Or if not, where does this interpretation of the law come from?
No, the law states it's no gender. You know, anybody that commits the offense should be punished by stoning. It can be man, it can be woman. The only lack there, the only problem we have is this proof, one of the proof of pregnancy as a conclusive proof of adultery. And for that also you go for stoning to death, which of course is a woman. The law itself, for some of us that have looked at it very closely, we think that it needs to be combed, it needs to be looked into again, for basic and fundamental reasons. Now, a lot of the positive aspect of Sharia has not been reflected in the law. And that is what we want to it to be seen.
Can you talk a little bit about the positive aspects?
The positive aspects are the fundamental rights that exist. Fundamental rights. Of life, of freedom, of privacy, of ownership. So many of them exist under the substantive law, which is the Quran. And these are not incorporated in the Sharia Penal Code law. So inasmuch as you want to punish for an offense of this nature, also provide in the law all the other necessary positive aspects of the same ground norm of the Sharia, the jurisprudence, which is the Quran, which give a lot of good things for women, for everybody, and we thought it should be part of the law, and it should be emphasized more. Now let me speak to one issue, and this is the issue of stealing. Now, if you look at the hadith that is speaking, the hadith is one of the practices of the Holy Prophet, which is the Sunnah, incorporated in the hadith. It's very clear that an environment, a society that has no lack, and this society that lack nothing, is a society that there is no poor and no very rich people. And the rich people will bring their zakat, one-tenth of what they owe, and keep it in a common purse.
Mm-hmm.
So the person that do not have that, do not have any means of livelihood, will always have it in this common purse. And so you do not have any need to go and take what doesn't belong to you. So everybody in the society has like a level feel of comfortability. We all have the basic necessity of life. So there is no need for you to go and steal,
mm-hmm.
to go and take what doesn't belong to you. Now this environment was the environment where we have the operation of saying, if you take, then cut off the wrist of the hand. It doesn't exist in Nigeria. Because there are very, very, very poor people. I'm not in any way saying stealing should be encouraged. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that the government that want to implement a law with a strict interpretation of cut off the risk in stealing must also provide an environment that they will reduce the level of poverty. You know, at times God has a way of doing things that human beings do not understand. Maybe God allowed this to happen so that through an incident like this, an opening will come for people to know how some people are living and how their condition needs to be improved to be part of the world system. And also for maybe the world to know some part of our ignorance, and for us to see how we can make using knowledge from all over the world to make our own system to work, especially with countries that are practicing the same Islamic laws and succeeding, like Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday in my paper, I mentioned that our penal code of Northern Nigeria of 1960 was fashioned out of one for Sudan. And over 90% of that is what is the Sharia Penal Code of Nigeria today. So if in Sudan it has worked well, and in India it has worked since 18... 1834, mm-hmm. and the Sudan was fashioned after the one for India. And since 1834, it has worked for India. So I think there is a need for us to see how has it worked in those countries, that it cannot work in our own country. I had opportunity to meet with some delegates from Sudan mm-hmm. last year, and I was asking them, do you have stoning to death in your law? They said, yes. Have you ever used it? They said, no. Since how many years? Hundreds of years.
Nobody has
been convicted. But why? Because the proof are very strict. And their own is not O, their own is AND. And to prove adultery is very difficult. So that's why we are not able to have conviction because of that. So I think there is need. I mean, we came to a conclusion in our very limited understanding. Yesterday I was overwhelmed when individual approached me. I didn't go to bed until after 2 a.m. And some of them came to the hotel and telling me their heart. And it's like, come to think of it, there is something that is different about human beings. You could see how attached they are to Amina from a remote village that doesn't exist on the face of the map of this world. But there is something in them that is touching her, and something in her that is touching them. And there is something unique I'm learning every minute, every second.
How connected we are.
Yes, how connected we are on this case.
Wow. The President of Nigeria, President Obasanjo, has said that it will be a very sad day for the country, and he would weep for Nigeria if the sentence was carried out. But yet, if the verdict of guilty is upheld, she is going to be buried to her waist and stoned to death. Do you imagine that happening, or do you agree with Obasanjo that it can't happen?
The truth is that I like shut off my mind. You know, I have read it many times. I've had it been said about how to go on killing somebody with stones, a throwing stone. I just shut off my mind to that. I don't want to think about it. So we'll do everything that we know of as lawyers to ensure that that kind of punishment is never meted out to anybody, man or woman. As regard to what the President of Nigeria is saying, he's entitled as a president to make statements. I don't join issues with him on that.
So you don't necessarily agree with the president's policy of viewing this imposition of Sharia as being a political act and just trying to wait until it dies down, because we heard the minister say that Islamic people, and especially young Islamic people in the states where Sharia has been imposed, are now sort of thinking twice and getting cold feet about it, and that he believes that in a couple of years it's going to be like voted away.
I really think that they should they can say what they want to say, but they should get to the grassroots. They should get to the grassroots and understand what is happening. And yesterday I also made it clear when the minister spoke that I didn't see so much of what government is doing strategically. You know, Nigeria is such a big and complicated country with so much diversity. The North are unique people. They are unique because they are very calm. They have very good listening ears.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are not that aggressive, really. And they have cultures and they have values. Now, within the context of who they are, approach them that way. There is need for them within the sensitivity of those people to approach them. And one of the best approach is a calm approach,
mm-hmm.
not statement. Call them. Tell them that maybe you don't understand nothing. Make yourself look really like a fool, even if you are the president. Mm-hmm. And ask them to help you understand something. Go to them. Humble yourself. Go to them. Get them. Uphold their dignity. Speak with them. Be noble with them.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make this thing work within your context? This is what Nigerian Constitution is saying. This is what this law is saying. How do we match it? How do we make it work? Tell me. I'm ready to discuss this thing with you. And I also see her in the diversity of Nigeria as a country. I see her as a uniting factor. I see her as an issue. The case of Amina Lawal as an issue. We hope that Amina's case is an eye-opener to a lot of mm-hmm. other people about how a system can tend to be an unjust system to its own people. and how, with a little bit of understanding and educational knowledge, you could make the system even better.
Finally, can you tell me, what message would you give to people, wherever they are in the world, as you say, like, you're really touched by how, you know, people are connected and they feel for Amina, and she somehow, despite her lack of education and her lack of a wide worldview, she can feel that too. But what can we do, people who do care about it but who don't live in Nigeria and who are in different contexts and cultures?
One thing I've noticed in Amina is that she is hopeful for life. And this hope is being kept alive by people like you. You're just keeping that hope for life alive. And I thank the international community. I think in our diversity, one thing has stood out to also be prominent, that we all yearn and hope for justice, for peace, for equity, for fairness. And I think that, in its sense, will make Amina as an issue a uniting factor in the diversity of the country.
It's been really inspiring to talk to you, and I'm particularly touched by how you are able to see something good in all of this and to take the hope. And you mentioned justice and peace, and I think because of people like you, we may just get there one day in the world. So, Hawa Ibrahim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah, for your time also.
For more information on this case, visit Amnesty International's website. Direct links to Baobab Women's Human Rights Project and to the petition to President Obasanjo can be found via the Merton Amnesty International's website. That's www.mertonai.org, www.mertonai.org. The date of Amina Lawal's second appeal has yet to be announced, so please keep following the case.